Welcome back, everyone. This is the Prepared Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Austin, and got a great discussion for you guys this week. Actually, sitting down with somebody who was one of my inspirations when it came to learning about how to host a podcast, learning on how to have these discussions, how to deliver messages in, I'll say, understandable and enjoyable context, different methods, things like that. Guys, this week I get to sit down with Mr. Kevin Estella, formerly of the Fieldcraft Survival podcast. If you guys were checking out Fieldcraft over the last several years, you know, for a long while there, you know, Kevin was like the mainstay guy. And aside from that, he was also a fantastic educator, somebody who spends a lot of time teaching Fieldcraft, spending time out in the woods. I know he's designed a couple knives. You know, I think he's had some collaborations with a couple knive makers over the past several years here, as well as, like I said, being an instructor. And I think his background actually is, in addition to learning the skills that we're all, you know, obviously very interested in, Kevin was actually a teacher. So his background is literally in teaching and education. I'm pretty sure it was history. I could be very wrong with that, but I'm pretty positive it was in education. So it's a unique opportunity to sit down with somebody, A, who has a lot of depth on something that is very valuable in the realm of preparedness, sustainability, survivability, right? When we're talking about the concept of getting off the grid or living away from home, things where you have to be very, very self-reliant and very self-sustaining. In that regard, Kevin's a guy who knows a whole heck of a lot about that, has dedicated a significant portion of his time, energy, his life, really, into learning those skills, and then specifically then teaching those skills, and dedicated himself to being a quality educator. And that's something we've talked about a bunch on other discussions and things, right? You know, being a subject expert on something is one concept, right? Being really good at doing a thing is another concept, right? Like, being good at something does not mean you're going to be a good teacher. But knowing what you know, or here, how can I rephrase this? Having the knowledge is one thing. Being able to execute on that knowledge is another. Being able to share that knowledge is a third. So I think that, you know, we'll get into a lot of interesting pieces of discussion when we're breaking this down today. Certainly, I think, you know, I would consider Kevin a subject expert and somebody who, even though he's branched out and gotten away from, working with Fieldcraft, there's a whole lot going on there, but still out there doing it, right? It wasn't a job for him. It's a passion. It is a, you know, a way of life. So I'm looking forward to this. Like I said, Kevin was one of my earliest inspirations in the podcasting space. I used to really, really get a kick out of his, I think it was Coffee and Questions was like the episode format he used to get, where people would just send in the most random of questions sometimes. And it's almost to where I figured out that some of them, you know, were just never asked, because I'm sure they were just very, very weird, but also that some people really, really did follow Kevin's teaching, his content, his courses, his curriculum, things like that, because some of these questions were follow-ons to previous questions or follow-ons from courses and things that people had attended. So, like I said, that was a inspiration for me, just very thoughtful in his answers and presentation. If I remember correctly, also a coffee connoisseur. I don't know if we'll get into that, but I was always drinking some kind of coffee, and that always just, when I was listening, I'd be like at the gym or something, right? And I'd be completely sweaty, and I'd always be like, man, you know, coffee sounds good right now. So I've been looking forward to this one, you know, since I got in touch with Kevin. Actually, shortly after we had Mr. Craig Caudill on, which is another fantastic episode if you guys want to go and check that one out. But before we get into this week's discussion, we got to jump into our ad space here, you guys. We have some fantastic, fantastic partners that support what I do here at Prepared Mindset and allow me to bring you guys along on this magnificent journey every week with these guests, with these discussions, with the learning, right? The stories and whatnot. And certainly that has to start with our friends over at Custom Night Vision, you guys. The website is customnightvision.com. And when I say that these guys are the one-stop shop for everything night vision, that's not me blowing smoke. That's not me, you know, embellishing. They literally are your one-stop shop for all things night vision. And I can positively reaffirm that, as I had a friend talked to me yesterday. Actually, he showed me the screenshots and everything. He's very, very proud. He's been working for a long time to save up to buy his night vision, and going through Custom Night Vision. Hey man, here's the website. I got, you know, the Lowlight Innovations MH1s, right? Because that's a terrific binocular housing that custom stocks regularly, was able to order the helmet that he wanted, was also able to get the battery pack that he wanted to be able to power that set of duals, and more. Honestly, I think I'm missing a couple of things. I'm not going to put his business out there, but definitely spent a pretty penny. And guys, Custom has everything you could possibly need to go from nothing to a complete night vision setup, whether that's binoculars or monoculars. So whether it's a single tube PVS-14, basically, which everybody knows, everybody loves, or again, something like the Lowlight Innovations MH1s, the rugged Manticore housing from Nocturne Industries, any of the great options from AB Night Vision, and honestly, guys, just anything you could really want. The Nighthawk from Steel Industries, they have that available. Tons and tons of options. They still have tubes from L3, very much available, very much ready for you guys to go pick up and throw into your housing of choice, depending what flavor that is. And again, they stock helmets from companies like Team Wendy. I think they still have some of the Galvion Cayman helmets in stock, which is what I grabbed for myself. Paid for that one on my own because I love supporting these guys. They're a fantastic company and they do fantastic work for all of you guys. Again, it's customnightvision.com. Go ahead, head over to the website. You can reach out to the team there, ask them questions to your heart's content, and they are there to give you the most transparent buying experience possible. You guys, again, Custom Night Vision, love those dudes. Fantastic company out of Houston. And also want to say thank you to a new partner of ours, Harrington Arms, guys, out of, I believe it's Salem, Ohio. And, you know, it never ceases to amaze me that, try as I may, I cannot help but find these awesome companies out of Ohio that I continue to work with and continue to partner with. And if you guys have never heard of Harrington Arms, you can check out their website. It's Harrington, that's H-E, not H-A, harringtonarms.com. And look at the entire catalog of products that they have available specifically around pistol compensators, you guys. They do some other stuff. They have other goods and services and things available on there, things like threaded barrels, things like magazine extensions. But really, what they're known for, what they do really, really well, better than many, is compensators. And if you guys listened to last week's discussion, we had Jake on again. Jake works at Harrington and dropped the bomb on their soon-to-be-released later this year, right? Combination barrel and compensator. So really, really exciting to see that when it gets released out here. But if you guys are curious about what they have, again, it's harringtonarms.com. Huge thank you to those guys for all of their support. Head on over to their website and check it all out for yourself today. Because you guys deserve nice things. So go pick up some gear from Harrington. Go check out Custom Night Vision. Those guys are both just fantastic companies and bring, you know, fantastic products out to the market. So super thankful to work with those guys. Glad to have Harrington Arms on board with Prepared Mindset. But like I said, this week's discussion and our guest is Mr. Kevin Estella. And we're going to get into a bunch of field craft discussions. I'm kind of a nerd a little bit about the knife thing. I know he's designed a couple. I don't know the specifics, I can't even honestly remember who they were with, but I'm probably going to try and sneak some questions in about that just because, like, I'm always fascinated with blade shapes and applications, and the stuff that looks really good is seldom ever the most effective for the things that you, like, realistically need it for. Like, perfect case in point, and this is not a dig at the company, but I love the leaf-shaped blades that Spyderco makes. And there's probably a really good reason why you don't see a lot of leaf-shaped blades on fixed blade, like field knives, because I'm sure there's some kind of like durability or something about the edge or the shape of the blade. You're probably really likely to like snap the tip of it. I'm thinking something like that. But when you get into field craft, I'm sure knives and cutting tools like that are probably some of the most valuable things you can have with you. I don't personally spend a lot of time out in the woods doing those kinds of things. I really wish I did. I know that's something I have to fix. That's not something that anyone's going to fix for me. But should be a really, really cool discussion with Kevin. Certainly one that I've very much been looking forward to since I was able to connect with him, get this on the books. I know he's a very, very busy guy, so excited for the opportunity. With that, let's just go ahead and cut on over to my discussion with Mr. Kevin Estella. Kevin, welcome to the Prepared Mindset, sir. How are you?
I am doing extremely, extremely well. Just getting done with an awesome day of filming and riding that high of knowing that we didn't have to take too many takes for some very difficult shots that we had to get. So things are good and, you know, just riding that high right now.
Yeah, I don't know that I actually thought about it because we were talking about that a little bit before we started recording and like, oh yeah, TV, cool. I never, yeah, I didn't even think about that. Like, if you mess up, I don't know, trying to like pitch a tent or something, like, hey, take it all down now. And you're like, dude, come on, how many times I got to put this thing back up? Like, that could be, you could waste some time doing that for sure.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. And I mean, the guys that I work with are professionals, and we've already done a number of shows together, and we've hung out together. They know me, they know kind of the flow of everything. And I've had weeks to prepare for one day of filming. So I had all of my props, everything that I needed to do everything from starting fires, with unconventional means, to setting up a tarp, to creating a perimeter alarm system. I had everything staged. So it was really just plug and play. But once they film it from the macro and you kind of get the whole picture, then they ask for certain things to be reset so they can see the detail of certain knots or the way that you position your body or whatever it is for certain skills. So, these guys were awesome to work with. I've worked with some crews in the past that weren't so great, but the guys from 4 Mile Post, they are the true professionals, and it was a great day of filming.
That's awesome, man. So let's do this. Let's have you introduce yourself to the audience before, while people, if anyone doesn't know, I guess, who you are. I think a lot of people do, but if they don't, maybe some context, and they'll understand why you're helping with the TV show, because you've got quite the background.
Yeah, so my name is Kevin Ostella, and I guess starting from the very beginning, I grew up in New England, had an amazing family life, the youngest of three kids. My father inspired me at a young age to go into the great outdoors because he survived in the jungles of the Philippines during World War II. And throughout my childhood, it was all about training and getting outside and reading as many books as possible. And eventually, I became a high school history teacher. And at the same time that I was teaching high school history, I was formalizing my outdoor education, going to schools like the Maine Primitive Skills School, Jack Mountain Bushcraft, and eventually the Wilderness Learning Center. So I started teaching professionally outdoor survival skills in 2007. So I'm kind of crusty and old, I guess you could say. I'm almost at 20 years of teaching outdoor survival skills and bushcraft. But since 2007, I've been a professional outdoor instructor. And at the same time, I've been a writer. And most recently, I left a private company that I was working with out in Utah as a full-time W-2 employee called Fieldcraft Survival, where I was the training director, and I traveled the country teaching survival skills. I was a podcast host, I was the lead blog writer, all sorts of things like that. And now I run my company, which is Kevin Estella LLC, and I focus on multimedia services, everything from video, audio, written work, as well as developing products and doing product testing. And of course, at the heart of everything is training, because at the end of the day, if you ask me, what am I? I am a teacher. So that's who I am. That's where I am. And that's what I've done.
Yeah, man. And that's, it's a lot, honestly, going from, and it's a weird transition too. I mean, kind of a lot of people, I think, have this stuff as a hobby, right? Like as a passion, have been doing it in varying degrees their whole life. Not to, I don't want to use the, yeah, I feel like it's a bad connotation in our community. The guys have like, they've been out in the woods since they were a kid and their grandpa taught them everything they know. And then a lot of these guys, for some reason, still end up being pretty ignorant. And I think it's that paired with like a lack of desire to really learn and grow and develop. But you like took it next level. So you had like, by all means, I believe anyways, you weren't just like dabbling in being a teacher. Like you were a teacher for a while. Like we're talking full, you were in mid-career and you pivoted like hard right. How did you figure out that that was like, you know what, I'm just gonna go for it?
So I've got one word that I think everyone's going to understand the frustration of the era, and that one word is COVID. And when I was a teacher, keep in mind, I loved teaching. I loved being in front of my students. I called them my baby birds. I was their mama bird. Every day I would give them a uncle tip, right? Like, this is how you properly jumpstart your car. This is how you travel, and pack certain things. Like, I would show them how to tie their ties, like before the prom. So I loved being with those kids because it was such a great, rewarding experience. And obviously, I'm teaching history, which is something that I'm very passionate about. Well, during COVID, it was so frustrating to be told, hey, we're going to continue providing world-class highly educational lessons when we had to do everything online, and the vast majority of what we had to do were simple check-ins where kids had to sign onto the computer. They would wave at me. I'd be like, "Hey, do you need anything?" "No? Okay, how about you, Tommy?" "No? How about you, little Susie?" And that was about it. They wouldn't let us do more. And then it was really frustrating when they said, "Well, what we're going to do is we're going to give everyone a passing grade." And I said, I had students that were mathematically impossible for them to pass for the year because they failed miserably leading up to that point. They never showed up, and we're just going to pass them? I was like, this is dishonest. So, with me, I tend to hold certain values very, very near and dear, and honesty and integrity is one of them. It was very frustrating to see the state of education. And around that time, I received a phone call from Mike Glover, the former CEO of Fieldcraft. And he said, "Hey, what if I were to offer you a job doing XYZ and we would give you a salary, benefits, this and that, but you'd have to
Sure.
move to Utah?" And I was like, sounds like an awesome opportunity. But of course, you got to test the waters. So I had flown out to Gunsight the week before, and I took the Gunsight 250 pistol class. I, finish up that class. I drive over to Prescott. I meet the team. I teach a class up in Prescott. I get to know the team, and I'm like, man, this is where it is. Like, I'm back in front of students. I'm watching the excitement on the students' faces, except this time it's not history, it's survival skills and combatives and everything. And I was like, how can I go back to teaching? So I had planned to leave teaching at the end of year 15. And I had made it 2 months in with the continued COVID restrictions, like one-way hallways, which was ridiculous. And then they told us that if we were not going to be vaccinated, we'd have to take a weekly COVID test that we would have to pay for out of our own pocket. And at that time, it was about $100. So I was like, so even if we work 9 months out of the year, that's still thousands of dollars. I'm not doing it, And I made the decision to leave. And the decision was a good one. It exposed me to a lot, but believe it or not, I just recertified for the heck of it, and I'm still technically a certified teacher, grade 4 all the way through 12. And if push comes to shove and I decide I want to jump back in front of the classroom, I could easily do that as a senior veteran teacher who's AP certified, and I happen to be male and in minority, so I think I'll find a job no problem if I want to.
And it, dude, it's so funny because it's always like the history slash social studies teacher, that has like the cool quirks and everything. We had one when I was in high school. Mr. Briggs was his name, and he was a former Marine, and he was that kind of guy. Like, everyone loved him. Like, his students, for the most part, I don't know of too many that actually hated him until I found him on social media years later, and things got super political. But always had that like good sage wisdom, was always like in good spirits, like loved what he was teaching. He taught our we did we took practical law with him, and then he had it was another, I think it was history. But yeah, he was freaking awesome. And always one of like the classes when people ask about high school, I'm like, oh yeah, this one time. And it was always his class. Ended up with a bunch of my friends in it every time, which I loved. He probably was annoyed, to no end, but it was, it's fucking fantastic. So it's weird that it's always a social studies teacher. I never had like a cool math teacher, or that I'm like, yeah, this guy was fantastic. Like,
Yeah.
it wasn't
So,
bad, but
Mr. Briggs, what era was he from with like his military service? Was he a Vietnam era Marine or Gulf
no,
War or?
he was just after. So he was in the 80s he was in. So he never, at least he talked about, he never mentioned seeing any kind of deployment or combat or anything like that. I did have, shoot, what's his name? I did have a freshman US history teacher, older gentleman. He was a medic in Vietnam, and he never
Oh,
talked about it.
wow.
Yeah,
Of
kids
course
asked him
not.
a couple
No.
times and asked him about it, and he was always very cool about it. He goes, "I just don't talk about it." Like, didn't get upset that
Yeah.
people asked, didn't say, flip out or anything. But he was, I think it was Mr. Tatum. I think that was his name. But he was an older gentleman, obviously. And yeah, I didn't find out what he did in the war until couple years later. Like, my mother was actually helping at the school as like a parapro or something, and she found out that's what he was a medic. I'm like, yeah, well, that makes sense then, probably why you didn't want to talk about it. I'm sure it's
Yeah.
pretty heavy stuff, and it's hard to really tell those stories to high schoolers without getting, kind of
Yeah.
graphic.
It makes you wonder if veterans from the Vietnam War had a platform the way that we do today with social media and everything, if they would have opened up more. But I think it was also a very different war than the global war on terror. Granted, you're fighting insurgent forces that are difficult to discern from the regular population. But at the same time, I mean, so much of the Vietnam War was televised, whereas the global war on terror, it was like a lot of the embedded, footage had to be screened and this, not, it wasn't as free flowing as it was through Vietnam. So I don't know if we would see that, if we could go back and give them a platform. But you're right. Whenever I've met Vietnam veterans, like my lit mentor Marty was a Vietnam veteran, I didn't want to ask him questions about the war, but when they came up, I also just let him talk, and I considered that privileged information.
Yeah, I mean, and if it's something where they can share, life lessons or things that were learned from that, it's incredible stuff, right? Because I think when we look at how that all went about, right? So like 18-year-old kids, just I mean, there's a lot of good things the military does in training. There's a lot of bad things. That war was handled pretty poorly with the draft and everything. So you had people who didn't want to be there that were forced to be there. And when you look at some, if those people are able to tell you stories of like personal transformation, or just even if it's just some of the field craft and bushcraft stuff they picked up for, I mean, it could be anything, it's like, wow, you learned this by living it, not like reading a book or watching a YouTube video. Now, half the people that are online that, subject experts, they never really done most of it. They just repeat what someone else told them. And I think it's so
Yeah.
cool. Those guys grew up in a time where they didn't have that. Like if they knew it, it's because they went and did it.
You know what's interesting? I posted, this was right around the time that I left Fieldcraft. I'm sorry, right around the time I left teaching. I posted an old school tip that my late mentor told me about. He's like, yeah, we used to line up all of our bullets on our foot locker, and we would look at the height of the bullets, and if any of them were seated too far low from being, chambered or, mishandled, he's like, we would ditch them because our life depended on it. And I posted up that tip, and I was like, hey, check your self-defense ammo, make sure that it's not, seated too deeply. You could have a catastrophic failure with your firearm, this and that. And I had people reach out, and they're like, who taught you that? And I was like, my late mentor Marty, who's a Vietnam vet. They're like, figures, and it was just one of those things. Like, that's not something talked about regularly unless you do everything that you can to set yourself up for success. And what was success in the jungle? It was not getting killed and being the most effective that those guys could be. So, I mean, if it takes you an extra 10 minutes to line up your rounds and say, okay, go, no go, so be it. You get to
It's
go
time well
in there.
spent.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah, and we I think a lot of that stuff gets lost too. I know when I like when I started reading into military history, I was like really infatuated trying to understand the GWAT and stuff, and I'm starting to work my way backwards, and I kind of skipped over a lot of the Vietnam and went straight to like World War II. I need to circle back around because I think it's a really underappreciated part of our country's history for I mean, I get why people don't like talking about it. I think it was horribly mismanaged by the government, by the military, by the media, in so many ways and everything. It's something I personally need to. I think I've read whatever Dick Marchenko's book. I read that one,
Red
and that
Cell.
was it was the one before Rogue Warrior, the one about
Rogue
him before.
Warrior. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, which is a good read. I recommend it to anybody listening. Like it is a really good book. I mean, did turn out by all means to be a little bit of a lunatic, but really, really good book. Great story. You do hear a lot about Vietnam and what the UDT teams were doing before they were SEALs. And well, there's some crossover there, but yeah, it's a good book. Great read on that era of time. But anyways, back to you, Kevin. So you made the move out to Fieldcraft, and so how did you get connected with Mike? Because I think a lot of people. That's like the dream phone call, right? They're like any company that they hold in high regard. They're like, yeah, dude, I would love to come out and instruct. And a lot of people really aren't positioned for it. And I said this when I recorded the intro before this is you have experience, you have subject knowledge, which I think are two very different things. And then being able to communicate that in an effective educational way. So people have to have, I think, all three of those if you really want to be good at teaching, especially something as specialized as like bushcraft and survival skills.
Yeah, so the phone call happened on June 30th, right? The text message, which happens to be my middle sister's birthday. So I
I was going to
remember
ask,
that
that's
one.
pretty specific.
Yeah. Well, I mean, history teacher, right? Like I remember things.
Yeah, good point.
So prior to that phone call, I was on Mike Glover's podcast. And prior to the podcast, the mother of Mike's twins, Victoria, she had handed the book over to Mike, and Mike, was like, this is the guy. Like, we want to expand the company, just move beyond the tactical stuff, actually teach survival stuff. This is the guy because, Mike was following my social media account and, through Filipino martial arts and Brazilian jiu-jitsu and going to shooting schools, Mike was like, well, this guy not only knows the outdoor survival stuff, but he understands the firearms community, right? I was a gun writer for years. So I was on the podcast. Mike and I hit it off. I mean, we have a lot in common, right? He's 3 months older than I am. We're both half Asian. We're both the same height. We tend to get mistaken for one another at trade shows. I can't tell you how many times people
Really?
saw me with a hat. Oh yeah, put a hat and put sunglasses on me, and people would say, "Are you Mike?" And that became a running joke at the trade shows. Like, how frequently were people going to mistake me? So Mike and I hit it off, and then, like I said, I got that text message, and it was almost divine in a way, in that, I had just lost my late mentor, right? An army survival instructor, an army infantry guy passes away, leaves my life. And then another army guy enters it with an offer saying, hey, you should teach for my school. Well, how many years before did my late mentor ask me, hey, you should teach for the Wilderness Learning Center? So I was like, there's something happening here, right? Follow the signs. And that's exactly how it happened.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's like that. Yeah, I mean, divine intervention. There's not really, I don't know what else kind of like label you put to that or anything, but that's, yeah, I mean, that's when you're looking to make a change in life. And I think a lot of people pray for that kind of thing, you know, whether it's for like careers or just a new job in the same career or something. So that's kind of just funny the way that it came together, you know, and COVID for everybody, you know, that was obviously the big turning point in so many people's lives. So at least there were positives that came out of it. So how did, I mean, you already had a curriculum put together when you were making that transition. Was that something you had like used at the Wilderness Training Center? And just, I don't know, was that Marty's curriculum, or was that like, did you modify that to kind of fit your own style of how you kind of approach the subjects?
So I'll say this, the curriculum, I don't want to say it was Marty's. I don't want to say it was mine. There's only so many ways you can skin a cat. But it's really the style that you teach, and there are some people that want you to experience failure first. But if you only have a 30-minute block of instruction with people and the culminating exercise is failure, well, you leave that person with a negative install of failure. So Marty was someone who was always of the mindset of, if I have 30 minutes with you, I'm giving you the best option first, the strongest option first, best chance of success, and then we can work your way back. And that's resonated with me to no end. So when I went to Fieldcraft Survival, I mean, obviously I had been teaching, this was 2020, so I was already teaching for 13 years in the outdoor survival space. I had
Wow.
so many repetitions of teaching. And through my interactions, with the military guys that we had, around the fire with Filipino martial arts, with SIOC, to hear someone say, oh, I'm a Green Beret, it was like, okay, but at the end of the day, you're still a man, right? We had a lot of Navy guys that were, within the tribe and around the tribe, extended tribe. And, it was one of those things where it was like, okay, I understand what these guys do, and they are highly specialized. But at the end of the day, they're a man just like me. So let's just, why do we have to be nervous to be in front of them? So it was funny because when I got to Fieldcraft, there, Kevin Owens and Mike were very good friends. And there were a few people that thought that I wasn't going to be able to make the shift going from a highly structured teaching environment, like teaching at the high school, to working in a very fluid, a very dynamic teaching environment like Fieldcraft, where, hey, grab your stuff, we're going up in the hills, we're shooting. Grab your stuff, we're going to go scout that property. Grab your stuff, we're going to, do some videos. And not having, the same structure that we did at the public schools, people thought, like, hey, he may not survive, but I did. It was very interesting going and bringing what I brought to Fieldcraft. A number of people said I put the survival in Fieldcraft because I brought the legitimacy of being a seasoned survival instructor, a published author, a best-selling author, someone who had been on television before. Like they got the prize when I joined, and I felt that way too. And when I first got there, initially, I'll say that things were great. They didn't last, but I will say that when I got there, it felt awesome to say, like, I've made it to this point. As you alluded to, the side hobby or the side business that I had for all those years when I had my primary occupation now took over. And now, instead of being a high school teacher first, I was a survival instructor. And, I made that transition like that.
So when you were putting that all together, then making the transition, setting up the classes, and there's planning to it. You don't just like one weekend decide, hey, we're going to start offering these courses. We're going to throw it up on the website for next week, right? How did you guys figure that out? Because I think it's one of those hard to understand concepts when we look at, and I talked about this a little bit with Craig Caudill when I had him on a couple of weeks back. Like, how do you introduce people to like it? It feels easier to us with a firearm because it's like, well, here's this one very singular object. You're going to hold on to it and pull the trigger, and we're only going to focus on this little space in front of us, right? Whereas with like survival skills, like where do you start with that? Because I know there's people that want to learn this stuff, and I think it's fantastic. And a lot of those people, especially younger folks coming out of, like you're talking about a bit ago, COVID, right? Where they were very much a shelter in the house, play on the tablet type generation. And you're finally starting to see people, get to that age where they can legally procure firearms. They're discovering that they want to spend time outside, that they, want to, I think I saw something too. People are like starting to, embrace Christianity and stuff like that. And I feel like it all blends together. We're seeing this like huge cultural shift towards that. So when you're like trying to put together a, hey, this is square one for somebody who's never really spent time, out hunting or hiking or so how do you figure out where's the logical step one?
Okay, so everything begins with mindset. And people right now are probably rolling their eyes, like, oh, another mindset talk or whatever. And it's funny because you hear a lot of people talk about the mindset, but their mindset is regurgitated, right? Well, this is what we have to say. Well, do you live that mindset? Because if you just think it and you don't act it, then there's no integrity. There's no, it doesn't match, right? Words and thoughts don't match with actions. So everything starts with mindset. And usually in the beginning of my class, I address what I refer to as the SIOC readiness formula. Now, the SIOC readiness formula comes from my late mentor, Chris Sayoc, Pamanatuan Chris Sayoc. And the readiness formula is three parts: awareness, preparedness, and willingness. Now, those three have to exist, kind of like the legs on a stool. And if you only have two out of those three, you cannot say that you are ready. And the beauty of this formula is that it is truly universal. It can apply to survival, it can apply to being ready for taking a road trip, it can apply to getting married, it can apply to taking a test. So awareness is what you refer to as like having your head on a swivel. It is your understanding of the world using every one of your senses, your past knowledge, and so forth, right? Your level of consciousness as well. Preparedness is not only the hard goods that you carry, but it's also the software that you use to program the hard goods. So you might have a pistol, but if you've never trained your pistol at 50 yards with a red dot, well, what's the level of your software that supports the hardware? And then the last element is willingness, which is the hardest thing for me to teach people. But I always tell them, if you've come to the class, you've already exercised willingness. If you wake up in the morning and you don't hit snooze, you're exercising willingness to take action throughout the day as opposed to react. And a lot of what I do is what's referred to as feeder receiver methodology, which is strictly SIOC, right? Feeders make things happen, receivers let things happen to them. So examples of people who only have two out of those three, right? Awareness, preparedness, willingness. There are people out there who are prepared and willing, but they're not aware. So imagine a black belt in any martial arts system who gets polluted with alcohol or takes mind-altering drugs. They're not ready. They don't know how to fight. They couldn't punch their way out of a paper bag, right? And then there are people out there who are aware and they are prepared, but they're not willing. And the perfect example of that are the officers at Uvalde, right? Where they knew that there was an assault happening, an active attack happening. We don't use the words active shooter anymore. We say active attack because you could have a car that goes through a crowd. It's not a shooter, it's an attack, right? So in that example, you have people who are aware and they were prepared, just not willing. And then the final example is the Flight 93 example. People who were aware and they were willing to fight, but they were on an airline. They didn't have the weapons. So what did they do? They took the beverage cart, they used it as a battering ram, they took pots of hot coffee and they used that as like a projectile. They wrapped their arms with clothing so they could fight off the attacker's knives. And in that moment they said, let's roll, right? And they became ready. So I always say, like, all right, guys, where do we begin? Let's talk about how willing are you? How ready do you want to be to learn these survival skills? Some of you may not even want to throw a Swiss Army knife and a ferro rod in your front pocket. And guess what? It's going to make life a lot harder because we don't have as good of a blade on our body as a stainless steel blade. We don't have a natural fire starter. And yes, I can show you how to rub sticks together, but a ferro rod will do it a lot faster and a lot quicker. Again, working from strongest methodology back. So when I start presenting ideas like this to people, they're like, okay, this guy's not a crazy guy. He's giving us good formulas that we can apply anywhere. And on top of that, it's a very easy way to make the logical jump from start state to end state. Here's the tool that can get you to boil water. Right, here is the tool that can help you carve what you need to make a trap or whatever it may be. And it's delivered just like this. It's not, hey, you have to kiss my ring, you have to honor me, you have to, because believe it or not, there are some schools out there where it's almost cult-like. And the reality is, none of that matters in the scenario where you may be, where it's just you. So if I can rewire the way that you think, if I can get you to address your readiness in all forms, then I can teach you just about anything.
I mean, and it's that kind of thinking that I like. I actually, now that you say that and spell that all out, it makes a lot of sense. I kind of like when I have friends that ask me about this stuff, one of the first things I always recommend to people is like, do you carry a knife when you leave the house? Like, well, I never used to. I'm like, well, maybe you should, and I get it. Like as a kid, or at least when I was growing up as a kid, it might be different now. My dad always had a knife and I'm like, do I want a knife? I didn't know how to use it. Probably shouldn't at that point I had one. But like by the time I was old enough to understand, I was like, I'm gonna start carrying a knife every day, at least as much as I could. When pre-COVID, I work in finance. They frown upon the whole weapons in the workplace thing. So I was like, all right, leave it in the vehicle, whatever. But having a blade with me is if I leave the house with nothing else, it's usually always a handheld flashlight of some variety and a good and at least a decent blade. It's usually a folder. I know fixed would be more preferable, but something like that where I can at least do some things. And then actually, I think it was one of the episodes that you did. I forget what the brand was now. It was a ferro rod. Purchased off your recommendation. I was like, this is really smart. Like, this is fantastic. It's got like the little metal tip with the, I forget the
Yep.
brand, but it keeps the,
ExoCap.
yes, that's the one. Yeah, it keeps the tinder
Yeah.
in the top of it and everything. And like that thing's, they're outstanding. People buy like the cheap ones from like Harbor Freight and like that shit doesn't work. I go, listen, if you get a good one, I swear to God it works. I will show you that it's different. And I've actually done it a couple of times where I'm like, here, this is way easier. Don't use whatever the hell that thing is. It sucks, but it does work. Having a knife is like the first step. And then people start branching out from there, like, yeah, I can carry this every day. And it becomes, kind of like you're saying, like a first step in that willingness to do more, to be better with your ability and capability.
Yeah, and I think a very powerful motivator, and I talk about this all the time. I say, if you're surrounded by people who care about you and you care about them, do not be afraid to use shame as a motivator. Because a very easy way to assess someone's readiness or assess their level of willingness, I should say, is with simple yes/no questions, right? It's easy for someone to have an open-ended response where they can kind of talk their way around things. But if you were to say, okay, you carry a cheap Harbor Freight ferro rod. Right? Yes. Is that the best ferro rod out there? Well, yes or no. Right there, you got them, right? And then on top of it, you can also say to someone, it's like, don't you want to be capable? And the answer should be yes, of course I do, right? If you are, and this is true of women too, but especially of men, because inherently we have such a protective vibe that runs through us. If you want to be considered a capable man, someone who's a get it done person, you have to carry tools. And if you do not carry those tools, you are just in the way. And I don't know anyone who doesn't want to be seen as capable, as someone who, when you show up, people are like, that's the dude right there. He's going to get this done, right? Otherwise, you're considered not as strong. And again, what's better than being strong, right? So, what do you say to someone? It's like, is that the strongest thing? Well, no. So you like weak tools, you know? And then, you know, you can always ask someone like, are you using your money wisely on the weekends? You just spent $100 going out with your boys when you could have spent that more wisely doing something to truly make you better prepared, you know, to self-improve. At the end of the day, you can only have so many drinks. You can only listen to the same music so many times, right? What really is going to make you a valued asset to your society? It's not the booze and the entertainment that you have on the weekends. It's the capability that you go after, you know, and that's through training or carrying certain tools and learning how to use them and surrounding yourself with people that, at the end of the day, you want those people around you, as opposed to your buddies, where you're like, oh God, we got to deal with, you know, again, I'll use little Jimmy. I think I said little Jimmy and Susie earlier, but it's like, poor Jimmy, you know, like we got to, let's just keep Jimmy out of trouble. No, Jimmy should be saying, I got this, guys, carry on, you know, do your thing.
And I do that, like I try to, honestly, at least with people that I care about, like that you want them to be around. Like I have a twin brother and he's still carrying a Glock 43, you know, like I think I got him some extensions because he didn't want to buy a new gun. I'm like, listen, dude, there's so many better options out there. Like you, like I've asked him before, I'm like, do you like shooting it? Well, I like shooting my Glock 19 better. Don't you think you should carry that maybe then? Well, yeah, maybe. I don't know. Like, no, like maybe you should look into carrying that, man. You should look into using that because you can hold on to it. It has more ammo. You shoot it way better. And, you know, it's, well, you know, him and haw, but it's like, man, if you want to be more capable, you don't want to. I mean, I get it. Everyone loved the 43 when it came out, just like the 365 and stuff. But if you think about it, like I, or at least the way I look at it is if you can shoot it well, then fine. But if you can't, then why you, it's no good as a tool to you. It's actually more of a detriment. And in the firearm spaces. And also I guess, you know, even with talking about tools like knives or multi-tools or anything like that, if you don't know how to use it, it's basically pointless to have it with you because you won't be able to do anything positive.
Yeah, and you know, I have a 43. I love my 43, but it's a very specific use firearm. If I go somewhere and I have to have my shirt tucked in and I can't conceal anywhere else, like let's say I'm going to a wedding or I'm going to a church function or whatever it may be, it's on my ankle. And compared to, say, like a five shot J frame, it's way easier to shoot with a consistent trigger pull, and it carries more rounds. It's 7 or 6 in 1 if I use the standard mags, and I have plus one mag, so I have 7 in 1 that fits on my ankle, and it's just there in case, which is better than nothing. There may be a time where, you know, I'll upsize and I can grab my 19, my 43X, my 45, which is my favorite. But the 43 is a great deep concealment firearm where you can use like a trigger guard, as opposed to a full holster, and just throw it in your pocket too. It also fits in a lot of small fanny packs, which if you're going to like the beach or anything, guess what? You got a gun on you. But it also, this is what I love my 43 for. I will go to the range and I will shoot a course of fire with my 43, and it is a firearm that does not let you make any mistakes. If you don't have good touch points with your thumb, the second knuckle on your support hand, you know, good pressure with that support hand, that gun is going to be all over the place. So I go from shooting that, and then I pick up my 17 or my 45, and it's a laser beam because that gun is way more forgiving. So, you know, there's hope for your brother. Don't get me wrong. Like, don't let him throw away that Glock 43. I love the 43. If he wants to get rid of it, I'll buy the damn thing. Because I think you can tuck him anywhere. And like, we live in America. If you want to have a shower gun, you could have a shower gun. And guess what? That's that little 43. Just put it in a Ziploc bag and put it up by the nozzle. You'll be good to go. Yeah, I love the 43, but I also know that I'd rather have a 43X. I'd rather have my 19. If I'm in bear country, give me my Glock 20. So I'm Glock through and through, man.
I was going to ask, because I know years, a couple years ago, you were, I think, a fan of the SIG products. I know you've attended the SIG Academy and stuff. So I was going to ask, like, with everything going on, like, have you switched over? You come over to the dark side for whatever reason? Everyone's like, oh, great, SIG has problems. Now we got to go back to shooting Glocks again. Like, maybe you shouldn't have left in the first place. I love mine. I love how ugly they are. I love how reliable they are. Like, I don't like the naming convention because every time someone's like, hey, I have a, you know, it was that song of the buddy, a Glock 45. That shoots 45, right? No, it shoots 9. What do you mean? Like, I don't even get me started. Like, just here, this is what it is. There you go.
And here's what I'll say about SIG. SIG is going through a rough patch right now, and I've owned two 320s in the past, and I've owned a 365 in the past. I do not own those any longer. I currently own a SIG 220 that I got on a police trade-in, and the gun is in near perfect condition. It's a traditional, or it's called the classic line, the DASA gun, right?
Oh,
Which it's not great for your first round. Like, most people throw that low left if you're right-handed, but it's a solid built firearm that you can rebuild it over and over and over. It has the decocker. It's a great winter carry gun because if you're wearing gloves, it has a massive trigger guard to get your gloved finger in. But it's a limited capacity gun that I travel to Connecticut with it. So when I go home and I visit family, I've got my SIG 220. I've got 10 round extended mags. I got a flashlight on it. Even though we're not allowed in Connecticut to have it set up with a threaded barrel and a suppressor, I just happen to carry those not attached because there's no law saying I can't have them. I just
You just can't put them
technically can't
together.
mount them. So I have a very capable platform when I travel. And I will say this about the SIG Academy. The SIG Academy is some of the best training I've ever had. And a lot of those instructors I'm still friends with. And they still put out a very, very good message of, hey, we want civilians to get trained. Now, what's interesting is that the SIG Academy has different instructors, or I should say different directors over the years, and they've changed the way that it's been taught, right? Like, at one point it was very combative, and then they brought in this other guy who said, we're no longer saying two to the body, one to the head. We're going to say two to the large rectangle, one to the small square, right? Because he didn't want civilians using that verbiage, right? But it's back to what it used to be. And they offer everything from pistol, shotgun, carbine, precision rifle. Then they have the specialized classes, the guest instructors. It's a world-class facility. SIG is going through some serious damage control right now with the way that things were handled, which I don't think their marketing person should be in charge of marketing anymore. And I think the only way out right now really would be to symbolically fire Ron Cohen, the president, and say, this is the guy who let it happen. We're starting anew, you know? And this SIG has to bring back manufacturing back to the States. They can't have parts made in India. You know, I don't think anyone would say, hey, you know, I'm gonna have an artificial heart installed. Oh, where was it made? India? You would not want that heart installed. And now you have something on your hip that has parts made from a country that has questionable quality. So don't get me wrong, like I still have a SIG firearm. I have a SIG 220, and I 100% have confidence in it. I just don't have confidence in the 320, knowing that there is even the slightest chance it could cause a discharge into my leg, and game over at that point.
And honestly, like when I was getting into shooting, and this, I mean, this is a while back, obviously, but some of those YouTube videos with, I'm gonna butcher this man's last name, so I apologize in advance. It's Adam Paincho.
Adam
Paincho.
Painter, yeah.
Who I think he was the director or one of the instructors at the SIG Academy, and he did several videos with, I was like the Outdoor Sporting Network or something like that on YouTube. It was some very odd looking dude with glasses and a green polo, and then it was Adam teaching you how to shoot and how to do, like, hey, this is what you do when your carbine goes to bolt lock and you transition to your handgun. And I was like, this is incredible, this is the information I've been searching for. And was really articulate, loved that stuff. And then I think I read online at some point that he had left, and so I still hold SIG as a, I guess, as a training facility and as a overall, like, the legacy of the brand, I still hold it in high regard. I think to the same point you made, like, I wouldn't mess with the 320 for
Yeah, I mean,
fairly
let's put
obvious
it this
reasons.
way. We can shift to vehicles, right? Like you could look at a brand like Chevrolet, right? So Chevrolet makes the Suburban. Everyone loves the Suburban. So cool. And then they came out with that Avalanche thing, and people were like, "What is that?" So like you can't, I mean, granted, it's apples and oranges there, but in the same way, it's a similar concept where you could either let one product destroy the reputation of a brand, or you could look at the other products that that brand offers. So I will say that SICK ammunition is pretty damn incredible. I do a lot with my chronograph and precision data on my rifles, and I geek out over ballistics. And the SIG ammo is some of the most consistent I found out of the box. SIG optics, pretty darn cool, right? Stabilizing features with your binoculars and range finding capability, and even a range finder that speaks to your optic and changes the elevation to make it one shot hits. Like SIG is doing some cool stuff, but I think at some point they've got to step back and say, we're not going to release a brand new firearm every week, right? Gun store owners hate SIG. They won't tell you that, but they do. Because if you're trying to have a stock keeping unit, a SKU of a SIG item, well, next week they come out with another. No one wants the 10 that are on your shelves. They want the one you don't have yet. And then when you finally get the one that everyone wants, they release another. Now you have 20 of those. So gun store owners love and hate SIG. Whether they love or hate is dependent on whether or not they're in public or in private.
And I mean, it is, it's neat to see, right? Because they got like, oh, the like the Max Michelle edition and the stuff, compensators built in and like huge magwells, and then you get into the minutia of all the stuff you can swap out. I thought honestly when they did the trigger, the trigger module that you can swap in and out, I was like, this is effing brilliant. How come nobody else is like, and I'm some of those guys, like I hate messing with all the pins on Glocks and stuff. I'm just bad at it. If I did it more, I'm sure I'd probably not care. But I was like, so yeah, I knock out one pin and then all the headache is gone. That like this is wonderful. And so I do, I hope they can keep that and then just fix, the other shit that's around it. And engineer themselves into a new platform. Because I think, that's a great concept.
Yeah, and I say they bring back the classic line, right? Focus on what they do really well. And if you
I love the
want
226. I want one
to, yeah,
so bad.
226 is a great firearm. And if you get a 226 Legion that's single action only, that's a solid firearm with a crisp single type of trigger pull with a 1911 style safety. Like that is such a great firearm. I mean, if they doubled down on that, I'd be like, guess what? I'm in
I'm
camp
buying
SIG again.
one.
Yeah, but I mean, what I love about the Glock is that whether I pick up my 43X, my 19, my 45, my 17, like I have a lot of Glocks, it's the same trigger press every single time. It's nothing that, is going to surprise me. They always say, oh, it should be a surprise. No, it shouldn't. It should be predictable, and you work out your flinch with dry fire. It shouldn't surprise you. That's going to lead to a terrible follow-up shot, I love my Glocks, but at the same time, I'm a firearms connoisseur. I have 1911s. I have revolvers. I enjoy shooting. And what I enjoy with all of it is sharing it. So, it's not uncommon if I'm at a class, I'm like, hey, try my B&T APC 9 Pro, right? Hey, try my Kings River Custom, Phoenix fighting gun. Hey, you want to try my 45 with a red dot? Have you ever seen the Koa on the 43X? Like, I just have too much fun sharing it, and I'm not sponsored by any one of these companies where I can say like, they're paying me, hand over fist. It's like, occasionally I get a discount on a firearm. Every once in a while I get a free gun, which is kind of cool.
There you
But that being said, a free gun doesn't keep my lights on, and I've had some of those free guns for a while, and I'm still brand loyal because I think they're the best guns in the world, right? So, yeah, it the firearms community is funny. There are people out there that'll say, oh, I'm not this or I'm not that. And then, the records, the receipts prove differently, you got to take everything with a grain of salt, and everyone should be doing their research.
So do you get questions on, I mean, 'cause like, I think in your space with the field craft and bushcraft side of it, it's probably different firearms questions than maybe what some other people get. What do you get questions on the most? Like, you mentioned if you were in bear country, you would carry, I think it was the Glock 20, right? Which is Glock 19, but chambered in 45.
So the Glock 20 is a 10 mil.
Son of
It has, yeah.
a So hard
So the
to keep
Glock,
track of this.
but hey, don't worry. Wait one more round, right? Glock 21 is the 45.
Great.
And then it goes back to, the worst caliber ever, which is the 40 Smith and Wesson. But hey,
Yeah, not a
I'm not
fan
going to go
either.
down that road.
Right,
The
right,
40
right.
Smith and Wesson already hates itself. I don't need to, pour any more fuel on that fire. So, yeah, the questions that I get when it comes to like the survival stuff, there are people in the survival industry that are very much of like the military mindset, right? The SEER community, the military training, they're going to say the only rifle you need is an AR-15. It's like, okay, I got that. Your scenario is you're running up into the hills, the Russians are coming, got it. And then there are people out there that are going to fall into like the traditional schools where they say, you don't need a plastic gun. Everything should be blued finish and walnut, right? Heavy wood, single shot shotguns. And I'm like, all right, I got that too. You're trying to live out the forest gnome scenario or be like the mad trapper. I got it, right? Lever guns are coolest thing ever. So I try to just kind of bridge the gap between those two, because the reality is you should have a quiver, so to speak, of, all right, I've got my 22 for plinking small game. I've got my shotgun, which is home defense, bird hunting, rabbit hunting. I've got my 30 caliber hunting rifle, which is going to take down deer, potential bear protection. And then you can also have an AR-15, or you can have not just the field grade shotgun, but a tactical shotgun, right? Like one of the roles I have is I'm a contractor with Obsidian Spear Group, and I teach tactical shotgun, defensive shotgun. And I always say tactical because it gets people into the mindset of what it is. But I always say, I'll show you how to shoot. I'm not going to tell you when, because that's ultimately up to you, and I shouldn't be telling you, hey, you can use lethal force here. That's your call. But I'll make sure that if you do decide to press the trigger, you're going to be accurate and you can run the gun like a boss. So the questions I get vary, and it depends on who I'm speaking to. With the guys who I've interacted with, the guys I currently work with the OSG, talking to them and finding out their hardware preferences, I can answer questions in the tactical space. I can tell you why 6.5 Creedmoor is a better round ballistically than 308, right? But then I also, from the hunting side, because I love hunting, and I'm itching right now because hunting season starts September 13th, and I'm already planning day one, right? From the hunting side, I can tell you, all right, this is how you want to set up this. This is the type of bullet you want to use. This is why you should pay attention to your ballistic tables inside of 500 yards, right? So I try to bridge the gap, and the questions are varied. What's the best first firearm? And I'm like, all right, to answer that, let me ask you about 100 questions. How big are your hands? Where do you live? What can you legally own? All sorts of things like that. How are you going to carry it? How's your vision? Things like that. Because if someone is cross-eye dominant, I usually just defer straight to get a red dot because it solves that problem.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. So a lot of it comes down to, who I'm talking to, but realize that I get every single type of question, and they're all fun to field because I'm talking about something I'm passionate about.
I think it's always interesting to me when people make some of those choices based off of general assumption. And I'm not like an expert outside of like I would say maybe defensive shooting or like I shoot ARs and I shoot handguns. Like not, I was Northern Michigan, so we get ton of deer up there, right? And I have a buddy who's got a family cabin up on like a private ranch, like huge, right? So DNR really doesn't come in unless they have a reason to or anything, but we were walking around, I think we were scouting for deer season, and up there they will actually they plant like rye fields and they plant corn fields, and then they will let people pay to come in and get guides to come if they get an elk tag, which elk I've never had it, still on my like bucket list to experience. But we're walking around through there, and he's been going up there since he was a kid, right? And he's like 3 years older than me, so he's getting ready to turn 40, actually. And we're walking through here, and we see a couple coyotes, and they like head down this hill into one of those cornfields, and I have no fucking clue why, but we're like, oh, let's follow them. we go down into this triangular cornfield, and we get to the middle of it. We're like, where the hell did they go? We go left, whatever, and it comes out to like these access roads that are kind of around this cornfield. And we turn and we look, and coming out of where we were just at, kind of like perpendicular to us, are two black bear cubs that come running out of the cornfield, across the road, and like into like the swampy, like forested, part of things, or whatever. And I look at him and I go, I thought you said you've never seen a fucking bear up here. He goes, I haven't. I was like, well, what do you think that just was? He goes, well, do you have your gun? I go, dude, my Glock 43X. Like, I was like, my Glock with hollow points isn't gonna do shit if mom is around. Like, and all he had was a shotgun with birdshot in it because that's all that you could get that time of year. And I'm like, dude, I really feel like you should probably invest in a larger caliber if this kind of thing happens up here. Like, how do you not have anything other than, like, did you even bring slugs with you just in case something happens? Long story short, basically, we just ran away. Like, nope, get the hell out of here. I'm not going to stick around to see if mom is here. I don't know, anything about bears. I've eaten it one time, not bad, but was not interested in finding out where mom was.
Yeah, and you did the right thing because there are people out there that want to live through the bravado fantasy of, oh, I took my firearm out and I shot that animal. It's like, okay,
No,
now the
dude, I
real
saw the
fight becomes.
Revenant. I saw how that went. No,
Yeah.
not
Yeah, because
interested.
the real fight becomes when DNR shows up and they say, all right, where were you standing? Where was that animal? Prove to us that that animal was charging you. And how far was that animal from you? Because, you took a shot at it where you still had time to retreat. Like, you're in for the fight of your life if you take a shot at an animal. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying like you should, not shoot animals and you should carry bear spray instead. I think both bear spray and a firearm are a good combination. When the conditions are right, bear spray works great. But you should have lethal backup. Always double down on lethal backup. And if you have two people, one person carries bear spray, the other guy's got the shotgun, right? Shotguns with slugs are pretty darn powerful. And a centerfire rifle with a quality round will penetrate, and penetration's king. But at the very least, I mean, you were thinking like, all right, I got my 9mm. You'll change their demeanor, And bears are interesting creatures. Like, I had a friend who was a guide who said every bear is an individual, and he would walk around in Alaska no issues with a 38 special. And I was like, with a 38, like that's basically like a
Jesus.
9mm. Right.
Yeah.
But he said the first shot is going to be at their feet to kick up dirt because bears, as large as they are, they don't like other things touching them. I'm like, I've never heard that before. And he's like, and the
Yeah.
following four shots would be at the bear if it didn't stop charging. So, I mean, I always ask people, okay, I understand that you are carrying something or you've set up your rifle or your handgun or your kit a certain way. The most important question is the why, right? So why are you doing it that way? And if someone says, well, other people do it this way, that's not a sufficient answer.
Yes.
Why do
Yeah.
you do it that way?
Extreme
Because I
depth
find
of
that.
research and understanding. Yeah. There you go. Because a video told me.
So getting back to that story with Marty and the bullets lined up on the Foot Locker, the why of that is pretty damn impressive, right? It's not just, hey, we do this. It's, I am de showing you my dedication to my craft. I am a professional. This is my job. And if you treat everything with that level of professionalism and you can explain things in depth, like this is why I like this blade shape. This is why I carry it this way. This is why it's designed that way, as opposed to, well, that's how it comes. That's not good enough. Like you should know your kit inside and out. Otherwise, you have work to do.
And that's so, and you touched on something there that I really wanted to ask about too, is you talk about blade shapes and knives and things. I know you've helped design a few. And I know there's a lot to it when you get into that. And so I just like, how many knives have you designed? I think three, four,
More.
more than
So, I
that.
mean, with Gossman knives, I designed the Polaris. I designed the ultralight Polaris. I designed the Gossman Bolo. I was part of the Gossman Predator design collaboration with him, Dwayne Unger, Lieutenant Mike, and Mike Travis. I designed the Winkler Knives Mentor. The Andy Roy Fiddleback Forge, K.E. Bushy. I mean, I've lost track. I think that's like six or seven right there. And there are more, and there are a couple that my name is attached to, in emails, but not publicly. And I'll just say that there are knives out there in the market that I've designed that if you know me, you probably know which ones I'm talking about.
So when you look at something like that, like how does that all come together? 'Cause, blade shapes lend themselves to certain tasks in certain tasks better in some shapes than others. And like I know for better or for worse, some brands stick to certain, like I know Spyderco does the whole leaf shape thing, which aesthetically I love my Spydercos. Not had the greatest luck with them as hard use knives. Like I've snapped the tip off my paramilitary 2 and then had to have it reprofiled, which is cool because now it's unique. But at the same time, I was like, fuck, I just ruined a $250 knife. Like, so when you look at some of those blade shapes and things, what's the logic that goes into some of that? And I don't, maybe that's a very complex, question. I don't know if we're able to kind of get into some of that, but it was definitely on my list of like things I wanted to make sure I asked you about.
No, I'll address it as succinctly as I can. I'm watching the time here, so I won't waste too much on it. But whenever knives come up in classes, I always say you can bifurcate them. You can break them down into two different categories or multiple categories, but it's very easy to follow the flow chart. So usually we say stainless or carbon steel. Stainless steel makes a great hard blade that is going to be more rust resistant, designed to be carried a lot, maybe used a little, and it usually will require a more significant sharpening method to keep it sharp in the field, like diamond as opposed to like an Arkansas stone. Now, carbon steel, on the other hand, carbon steel is very tough, a resilient steel. And carbon steel will take a very, very fine edge. And you can usually sharpen it way easier in the field with a less significant sharpening stone. Now, once you get away from the two different steel types, broadly speaking, right, carbon and stainless, then you can get into the purpose. Are we talking fixed blade or folding? And sticking with just the fixed blade, well, what size fixed blade? Is it going to be something that is meant to be a belt knife, like a 4-inch blade? Is it a chopping tool? Is it meant for thrusting or slicing? And usually thrusters don't make great slicers, and slicers don't make great thrusters, because, or I should say, choppers don't make great thrusters because a chopping blade typically has a lot of weight forward, and a good thrusting blade has the weight in the handle because you want to drive with, well, with the weight in the back. So, you start looking at the knives that have been used historically, and that's where the logic really begins. Like, okay, let's look at these knives that the best and the brightest have used before us. And you look at knives of like Horace Kephart, George Washington Sears. You look at the knives that outdoorsmen have used, and the knives that were from different generations of outdoorsmen. And you say, okay, what was the common complaint? Okay, that one was too large. That one was too small. What does the handle look like? Which is often something that's overlooked because everyone wants to focus on the pointy side, but your handle will tell you how that knife wants to be held. And a very neutral handle can be held multiple ways. So when I designed the Gosman Polaris, I wanted a handle that I could hold in forward grip, reverse grip, in saber grip, in a pinch grip, every which way. Certain knives, when you grab them, they force you to hold them a certain way because they don't feel comfortable otherwise. So a perfect example of that is if someone were to grab like an old school ruler, like a child's ruler, like a 6-inch ruler that you'd have in your pencil box. If you were to try using a knife that is flat like that without a round handle, you're probably going to pinch it and you're going to hold it sideways instead of straight on, because when you hold it straight on, it rolls in your hand. So really, the best designs come from the field. And we joke and we say, like, we're going to take this design to the lab. And when I've worked with different knife makers in the past, I'll receive a prototype and it's like, try this, right? Perfect example, the knife that I designed with Josh Smith from Montana Knife Company. So there's another one, number 7 or 8. That knife, he and I, we looked at other knives that I carried for defensive purposes, like my Amtac Northman, and we looked at my Atienza Kali EDC 4, and I said, hey, I like these features, this feature, here's the sheath. Many times the sheath is often overlooked. I mean, the knife is going to spend the majority of its life in its sheath rather than your hand, and a sheath has to make sense for the purpose. So if you're carrying a defensive blade, you don't want a sheath where the knife is almost fully enclosed by a deep pouch. You want as much of that handle exposed so you can get a good master grip on it. Well, if you have a good master grip on your knife, It doesn't necessarily make it the best bushcraft or emergency survival knife, because in that scenario of bushcraft or emergency survival, there's no urgency to access it quickly. So why would you need to have that handle there? You should have it as deep embedded in a sheath as possible where it's not going to fall out. So at the end of the day, when it comes to designing a knife, I mean, there are other factors that come into play, like of the carbon or of the stainless steels, which ones, right? Like what particular metallurgy do you want in the steel to make it rust proof or easy to sharpen or tough or flexible? And then what blade shape do you want? What edge geometry do you want? Do you want it to be a full flat grind, a convex grind? Do you want it to be a short flat, sometimes referred to as a Scandi? I mean, the list goes on and on and on, but you look at what is the main objective of that tool. And then from there, you create the criteria. And you always create the criteria and then design the knife, as opposed to, here's a knife, let's make it do this. That's usually the worst, because now you're trying to fit something like a square peg into a round hole,
Right.
rather than coming up with something unique that addresses a problem, based on the criteria of the tool that would fix it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a ton about knives, but I know when people ask me for friends and stuff, like, oh, I want to buy my husband a knife. What's a good knife? And I'm like, well, what does he do with it? And I like, hey, you don't want that necessarily because HCR13 MOV is a really cheap steel, like it works for some things. Is he gonna be using this every day at work? Because he's probably gonna get really frustrated with that. Or like D2. I know a lot everyone's moving towards D2 in the I'll say like the very commercialized market, right? Where you're just trying to sell volumes of knives. But I know when you get into like some of the nicer ones, it gets a little bit better than that. And that's obviously why I think a lot of these blades are they're usually upwards of like $200, especially getting like a good folder or a good fixed blade. And I think it's hard for people to understand, but it's like, well, I think it's the quality of the metal. And until you use a really, until you've used a truly exceptionally shitty knife, you never really appreciate having a nice one because that'll really do it. Like I've had some truly bad knives, and I'm like, you know what? I won't spend less than $100 on a knife now. I just won't. It's not worth the headache.
Yeah, and you're spot on with the sticker shock, right? People are like, how could you spend $300 or $400 on a knife? And it's like, realize that that knife is just as valuable as a self-defense tool or as a survival tool as your firearm, right? And what's this, most knives are going to be less expensive than your average firearm, especially if that firearm's red dot equipped. When you look at like the knife design process of, say, like the knife I did with Winkler Knives, right? My mentor, that knife is going to be water jet cut, not laser cut, out of the 80 CRV2 steel. And by water jetting it instead of laser, you're not already destroying the edge of that knife with high heat. So water jet is more expensive, right? And it's going to make a better knife. And then on top of it's going to be heat treated by people who have been in the business for a long time, and they have that recipe, that formula down. And then on top of it, I mean, I've toured the Winkler factory multiple times. Winkler has one machine in particular that all of the knives that come through Winkler Knives, they go into before they're ground. And what that does is it what's referred to as de-stresses the steel after heat treat. So if your knife is going to break or if it's going to bend or have any issues or whatever, it's going to be because a lesser maker did not de-stress it, right? Normalize it, de-stress it, all that. So Winkler goes through all these stages before it's even handled by a craftsman to do final assembly. And when you realize all of the machining that goes into the knife and all the processes, then you're like, okay, I understand why that is much more. I understand why that finish that they use is much more than just bare steel that's going to rust on you. And then on top of it, if you're paying that much for a knife, and I won't just be exclusive to Winkler, I'll talk about my friends at Etsy Knives. If you damage one of their knives, you most likely can talk to someone at the shop and be like, hey, I had an issue with a knife. What can be done about it? And if they don't give you a discount on one, they'll probably just give you one for free. I know Etsy does that, and Winkler will probably look at it, and if they determine that it wasn't abused, they'll probably take care of it under warranty. So a lot of these companies that are charging premiums, they are going to stand behind their product, more so than a nameless company from overseas where you don't know who made your knife in that sweatshop or whatever.
Right.
It's great when
Yeah.
you can call a company and talk to the guy who made your knife. Like, I
Well,
was
and
hanging out with, yeah, go ahead.
I don't think that Etsy is even that like they're actually, I would say, on the more affordable side of things, at least
Very
with there's a
affordable.
large majority of their catalog. I think it was, see, Azula, it's a two or the three or something. I got one of those as like a Christmas gift, and it's fantastic. It's a small little knife. It's great for like, 'cause I don't go out a whole lot or do anything crazy, but great knife. It actually has a really sizable handle for compared to the size of the blade that you can swap out, like if you don't like micarta because you're a simpleton and you don't understand how great it is, and it came with it. I didn't love the sheath, but it at least works. You can attach it with Molly straps and stuff, like, and I think that was like a $60 knife, something like that, 65. It's really very affordable, and has the benefit of it's also a quality knife, so you're not going to just be buying junk that you're going to replace in 2 years or something like that.
Yeah, and what's wild is there's a whole secondary market for a lot of these companies. So, with a lot of the Essie knives, if you're not happy with the handles or if you want to modify your knife, there it's like a collector's club, right? Like these knives are basically like adult Legos in the same way that you can modify an AR-15 indefinitely. So you can buy different colored handle scales that incorporate like a survival function where there's storage inside of them. Like the internet is an amazing place. You can find a lot of good information out there, and there are still many good people in these discussion boards that are just like me, where it's like, we want you to get out and use cool stuff. Like, we want to be the best spokesman for the brands that we use because we believe in them. And that's part of that mindset component again, right? Like, I know that I'm ready to use my tools. Like in the filming today, I had to use my knife to cut open a can. I did not hesitate to put my knife through the aluminum in that can, because I trust my knife. I know it's going to work, right? And if I were not as willing, that particular shot we got today wouldn't have happened. So everything is overarching in the survival industry and in the survival world and in the world that we live in, with the way that we view things from ourselves, like the level of physical readiness we have, our spiritual readiness, and everything like that, to the gear that we carry. It all starts with mindset, like how well do you know your knife? Guess what? That's awareness, right? And is your knife sharp? If it's not, guess what? You're lacking preparedness, So like I can bring it back to those three principles and gauge someone's readiness just by looking at their kit. I always ask people, when you're done with the shooting class, do you clean your gun? Well, I didn't shoot it a lot. Is it in the best possible condition right now? Yes or no?
Yeah, I actually,
It's
that's one of like my, like, I do that after classes. It doesn't matter how, if you only shoot a couple hundred rounds, I'm like, nope, got to come home. I take it apart. I clean it. Well, range sessions, maybe not always, but classes I usually do. And it's just become like a regular practice. It's almost like it's kind of like a therapeutic thing at this point where I'm like, right. And they sit there, reflect on everything that I learned or thought about. And yeah.
if someone says, hey, I don't clean it for 500 rounds, but they say, because I'm using a lube with my firearm that actually mixes with the carbon and it creates a slurry that's more effective, I'll be like, perfect. Guess what? You explain the why,
Yeah.
rather than someone who says, well, I don't clean it. Why? Why would I? Like, if someone's asking me the why instead of explaining the why, that's a problem.
You
So
see, that's
again,
and that is one of the things I hate the most in this community that a couple people made really popular, where they just like, oh, I don't clean my guns. If it blows up, I just get another one. I'm like, all right, well, as cool as it was when Pat Rogers said that because he's friends with Paul at BCM, or as cool as it is when, Lucas Botkin talked about how he didn't clean his rifles and stuff. And, I was like, all right, like, I get you don't have to clean it every, 100 rounds. Like, right. Like, some people will obsess over that kind of thing. I get it. But then you have people who are proud, like, it's been 5,000 rounds since I cleaned this. I'm like, that's disgusting, dude. Like, what, how, that poor rifle, like, what are you doing? Come on, man. You
yeah,
expect that
it's
to
not as
function when
much
you
of
need
a
it to?
flex. It's not as much
Yeah.
of a flex as you think it is.
Yeah,
And
it's
then
just
like they always say,
embarrassing.
like you can judge someone by like the way that they keep their car, and then people are like, well, I don't need an oil change. And it's like, your oil is the lifeblood of that vehicle, And like again, everything that you do says something about your character. Getting back to the high school history stuff, I used to say that to my students all the time and they hated it. And I used to love saying that because I was like, look, how you set up your notebook, how organized you are is a reflection of how effective you are. And if you don't know where things are, you're not organized and you're not as effective as you could be. And I want you to be the best version of yourself. So again, whether I say that to someone who's packing up their day pack for a hunting trip, or if I say that to a 14-year-old kid or a 18-year-old kid in one of my high school classes, or I say that to someone on the shooting range who, reaches for a magazine here 1 minute and then they do a round, a course of fire, and then they reach for the magazine somewhere else. It's like, if you're not building in consistency and organization, you are putting yourself behind the power curve. So a lot of that is so universal. And, it's just those are the lessons I really cherish teaching, because every once in a while it clicks and someone's like, you know what? I am going to go home. And before I take care of myself, I'm going to put my firearm away, because I've fallen asleep before and I've had a dirty gun in the morning and there could be something that happens at night. And you know what? Good for them. That makes me happy. And I'm not saying it to be a jerk or to, pound my chest and be like, we always do it this way. It's like, I want you to be the best version of yourself. I do things my way, which might not be your way, but it is a way. And ultimately, I want you to find the way that works for you.
Yeah, and as an educator, I think that's like leaving that impact. I used to teach high school music extracurricularly, so marching band at my alma mater and stuff for like Jesus, hold on. So when you started teaching outdoor survival was the year I graduated. So then I stopped teaching like a year ago. So it was a while. Anyways, but if you could actually pass on any of those like best practice, best like life hack type tips where you're like, hey, I know aside from what we're talking about today, like here's something that like guys, I've been where you're going. Listen to me, don't listen to me, but here's what you should know. And it's only been a couple of times. It's always like really cool when you have a student come back or like message on Facebook or something. They're like, hey, I don't know if you remember me. It's only been like one time where I was like, I genuinely don't remember this person. They come back and they go, hey, this was really helpful. I really appreciated all this. Like, I kind of hated you at the time, but like now being an adult and out in the world, like I see how different things are. I really appreciate it. So as an educator, I feel like that's always like the coolest part when people are just genuinely appreciative and not even appreciative, just like you can tell that you made an impact. You know, it's a really good feeling.
I've got a couple of kids that I've got on social media now. They're like 30 years old, and it's funny, like there are still some that refer to me as Mama Bird. They're like, hey, Mama Bird, and I'm like, I'm 45 years old and
You guys could
you're in
stop
your
now. We could legally have a drink together. Like, this is getting weird.
And it is funny because I've got some former students that have such dark humor, and they've always known that I've had a dark side. Like, they'll send me the funniest memes, and I'm like, man, you guys are making me smile, and it is really cool. And that's what they always say with teaching. And maybe I can just impart this on the listeners, is that they always say the greatest reward with teaching is not June, July, and August, right? People think, oh, you teach just have the summers off, right? Or no one goes into teaching to become wealthy and super rich financially, but we have wealth that other people will never realize, because they say a teacher's wealth is never knowing the greatest influence that they have, right? The extent of their influence. I've had former students who have gone on to military academies, and that makes me proud as hell. I've had former students who have become doctors and lawyers. I've had former students who have become teachers. I've had former students who have joined the military and served this country. And it's like every one of them, like, I would be proud to shake their hand. So how many lives have I affected? I mean, you could do simple math and say, for 14 years of teaching, did I have over 100 kids each year? Yeah. So I probably had well over 1,500 kids that have come through my class. But I'll never know who they taught a lesson that I taught to them, and that's the most exciting thing about teaching. And that's actually one of the reasons why I'm contemplating, like, maybe I will go back to teaching back in Connecticut and finish up, say, 25 years of teaching, collect a pension, and I'll still do my outdoor stuff on the side, because I write quickly and I can teach on the weekends. So I can write a blog, a 1200 word blog in an hour while I have my coffee, and I can teach on the weekends and I can still be a teacher. So I haven't decided that yet, but man, I'm telling you, I'd be lying if I said that I haven't been contemplating it, because I do miss having that in my life.
Yeah, likewise. I actually got a call a couple weeks ago to resume teaching in a different capacity than what I had before. And I'm like, okay, I'm actually interested. I'm entertaining this thought. Like, talk to my wife. I'm like, okay, look, listen, I know it sounds like a lot, but hear me out. So, yeah, I don't know, but it's a really cool feeling. With anything, it doesn't have to be, for me, it was music, but with it just it is, it's a great feeling.
For sure.
I know we're kind of coming towards the end of the time we have. So I did want to just ask if people have questions, and they haven't figured out where to get a hold of you. I know you have your own website, you're on social media. Where can people reach out to you? Where can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, so the first thing I'll say is do not hesitate to contact me. I'm just another dude at the end of the day, right? I always say that, I was probably in your shoes at one point, and I know that I reached out to people who were my seniors, people who were my elders, people who I looked up to, and every once in a while, one of them would get back to me. And it meant the world to me because it let me know that I mattered. And I will tell you guys, if you reach out to me, I will get back to you one way or another. If you send me dark humor, I will definitely send you a thumbs up. Like, that's pretty cool. But you guys can reach out to me at www.kevinestella.com. That's my website. And on social media, whether it's Instagram or it is Twitter slash X, it's at Estella Wild Ed, which was short for Estella Wilderness Education. So Estella Wilde. And you guys can email me too at kevinestellallc@gmail.com. I will tell you that if you email me, you're going to probably get the best response. If you send me a message on Instagram, I might even, if I'm driving, send you a voice recording back because I don't want to spend time like a high school kid
Yes.
texting away. I'd rather just send you a 30-second message and you'll be like, oh, they actually called me. And I might have a bunch of craziness going on in the background, but I will get back to everyone that reaches out to me.
Yeah, no, I've also embraced the voice memo or voice message because I'm just like, man, I hate typing. Like, this is so bad. Why? But I don't trust talk to text to do it right. So I'm like, all right, people are getting voice messages. So, but I've really appreciated the time, Kevin. This is awesome. Definitely a conversation I was looking forward to. Like I said, I listen to you a lot when you're doing the Fieldcraft pod. So a source of inspiration for me, and certainly a wealth of knowledge for the listeners here. So, appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. And yeah, I'm just happy to share what I have, and whether that's in person or in books or in a class or whatever, just realize that, I've got good intentions. I want people to be the best, most capable version of themselves.
Awesome. Absolutely. I'll definitely be in touch, sir. Would love to do this again in the future. Yeah, take care, and we, like I said, we'll be in touch, man.
Sounds great. Thanks so much again.
So cool to finally get to sit down with Kevin and talk with him, and honestly, what an eclectic conversation that we had. Going from talking about his experience and how he got involved with Fieldcraft Survival, right, and teaching. And we didn't even actually get into how he got into teaching, and I think there's probably several podcasts and things out there with his Wilderness Training Center and stuff where he I think is where one of the places where he taught previous to that. But he had been teaching, he said, wilderness survival and those outdoor skills for like 13 years, up to that point where he left his teaching career. So it's been like a lifelong passion, and it's so cool to be able to interact with those kinds of people who share that passion at a level which, I think a lot of us aspire to, and really you invest yourself and even said, hunting season's coming up. I'm already planning, my first trip out, and here in Michigan, certainly people are very, very big about hunting season, deer season here in Michigan. I did not realize this until just a couple of years ago. People actually travel to Michigan to come hunting, and I was like, Michigan kind of sucks in, in the fall it's nice if you're going to like, some of the vacation-y spots like Traverse City and stuff like that, but people actually come here to hunt deer. So it's a really, really big deal. But Kevin's a little bit of a different character compared to some of the other guests that we have when we focus a lot here on, like the tactical shooting space. And we talked about some of those things, certainly maybe I'll have him back on. I'll ask him to come talk about, tactical shotgun. That's something that I have not done much with at all, and probably have a ton to learn in that regard, because I don't necessarily enjoy shooting shotgun. But if it's something that something that you guys want to hear about, and something that Kevin can obviously speak on, hey, there's a great opportunity right there. And I really, I had a lot of good takeaways from this. You know, the awareness, preparedness, willingness piece. I think that triangle, that stool of sorts, kind of like what they teach you in school with fire. And I think we referenced that honestly in the discussion. It won't stand up. You know, without all three legs, you won't be successful. But we talked about that quite a bit. We talked about mindset a lot, you know, and living with that purpose and that mindset. And it was just such a great conversation. You know, I really was looking forward to it. Definitely didn't disappoint. And if you guys are looking to learn that kind of stuff now, or maybe you're looking to take a field craft course or something like that, I highly encourage you, take advantage of the information there at the very end. Reach out to Kevin, send him your questions. Even if you're not somebody, if you don't think, or I guess if you don't consider yourself to be somebody who's quote unquote really into this, really deep, and you don't think that maybe it's worth the time with the question, like, I urge you guys, anytime we have guests on here that make themselves available for questions, for outreach, for contact, man, take full advantage of it. I would not be where I am, and I'm not saying that I'm anything great, but I've had some very, very, very generous mentors over my several years that are willing to put the time in. I've had people draw diagrams for me, do special edited videos. I've had guys send you obviously voice messages and voice memos. People are very generous if you give them the opportunity, and I think that certainly Kevin's no exception to that. You know, this was a fantastic discussion. And if you guys did enjoy this, by the way, please think about pausing and hitting the subscribe button, because all of that stuff, all the listens, all the downloads, all the subscribes, that stuff really, really helps me out when we're trying to grow and bring on guests like Kevin or bring them back on and find the time and the availability and stuff to do this. And it helps me as well too. So when I say, hey, that, you know, that episode performed really well, or if you guys leave a comment, something on the show notes or the comment section, I'm sorry, for Spotify, and you let me know, hey, I love this, Kevin's outstanding, or if you guys want to shoot me a direct message and let me know, this was great. Dude, I'll do more of this, man. My goal is to learn with you, and when we have people on that have this depth of knowledge and this like level of understanding and experience, it's endless learning for me and for you guys. So that's why I'm here. That's my overall mission and goal with why I started Prepared Mindset 5 years ago and why I continue to chase it today. I mean, like, there's days where I think about it, you know, even today I was like, man, kind of tired from work, you know, but hey, this is gonna be a great discussion. I'm really looking forward to it. And it was outstanding, man. But the grind, you know, it's all part of that mindset, that mission that we chase that I think we're all individually after. So like I said, yeah, if you guys are enjoying this, please show us some love, hit a subscribe, check out the YouTube channel, go check that out. We got lots of good information dropping over there, all kinds of good things, folks. But I really do just appreciate if you're listening to this point, hanging around, hearing what Kevin has to say, hearing what I have to say. It means a whole heck of a lot. But that's all I got for you guys this week. It was an outstanding discussion, and looking forward to, by all means, the next several weeks here. Got some really cool guests lined up for you guys as we're, sadly, looks like we're rolling out of summer as we cross from August into September. I think between this episode and next episode, we'll break into September, and it will be, you know, we'll officially, I think, officially be in fall. I don't know if the equinox or whatever the heck happened, but I officially count it as fall once we're in September. So thank you guys so much for listening. Stay safe out there. If you're still out there able to enjoy those last little bits of summer, and obviously the holiday weekend coming up, do so safely. God bless everybody, and like we always say here, work hard, train smarter, and be prepared.